Message? No, faxes, Gansey corrected himself. Pretend I didn't say letters. Faxes is funnier. Blue laughed into the pillow. Okay, that was all. All what? All I had to say. I've learned a lot. I'm glad you misdialed. Well, easy mistake to make, she said. Might do it again. A very, very long pause. She opened her mouth to fill it, then changed her mind and didn't. She was shivering again, even though she wasn't cold with the pillow on her legs. Shouldn't, Gansey said finally. But I hope you do. 5. The following morning, Gansey and Mallory went out to investigate the ley line. Adam agreed to join them, which surprised Gansey. It wasn't that the two of them had been fighting. It was that they'd been not fighting. Not talking. Not anything. Gansey had kept going on the same road he always had, and Adam had taken a fork onto a second road. But for the moment at least, they were headed in the same direction. Goal? Find another entrance to the Raven Cave. Method? Retrace steps from previous ley line searches. Resources? Roger Mallory. It was a good time of year to show off the town. Henrietta and her environs were a paint box of colors. Green hayfields, golden cornfields, yellow sycamores, orange oaks, periwinkle mountains, cerulean cloudless sky. The freshly paved road was black and snaking and inviting. The air was crisp and breathable and insistent on action. The three of them moved quickly until Mallory's attention was caught and held at their fourth stop of the morning, Massanutten Mountain. It was not the most mystical of locales. Neighborhoods bubbled from its sides and a ski resort crowned it. Gansey found it coarse, tourist, and student fodder. But if he'd said it out loud, Adam would have torn out his throat in a minute for being elitist. The three of them stood just off the road, avoiding the stares of slowing drivers. Mallory was all turtled over behind his tripod, lecturing either Adam or himself. The procedure of ley hunting is quite different in the States. In England, a true ley must have at least one aligned element. Church, barrel, standing stone, every 2 miles, or it is considered coincidental. But of course here in the colonies, both boys smiled good-naturedly, everything is much farther apart. Moreover, you never had the Romans to build you things in wonderfully straight lines. Pity, one misses them. I do miss the Romans, Gansey said, just to see Adam smirk, which he did. Mallory sighted his transit through a gap in the trees toward the gaping valley down below. And although your line is now awake and profound, positively profound with energy, the secondary line we're looking for today is Curses! He had tripped over the dog. The dog looked at Mallory. His expression said, Curses! Hand me that pencil. Mallory took the pencil from Adam and marked something on the map. Go sit in the car. Excuse me? Adam asked, polite and shocked. Not you, the dog. The dog sulkily retreated. Another car slowed down to stare. Mallory muttered to himself. Adam absently tapped a finger against his own wrist, a gesture somehow disconcerting and otherworldly. Insects buzzed around them. Wings brushed Gansey's cheek. A bee, maybe. I could be dead in a minute here, maybe, by the side of this road, before Mallory can get his cell phone out of the car, before Adam realizes what's going on. He didn't swat the insect. It buzzed away, but his heart still beat fast. Talk me through what you're doing, Gansey said. Then he corrected, us. Talk us. Mallory adopted his professor voice. Your cave is tied to the ley line, and it has no fixed location. Therefore, if we're looking for a cave to join up with it, there's no sense searching for ordinary cave entrances. Only an entrance on a ley will do. and as your cave mapping suggests that you are traveling perpendicular to the lay instead of along it, I believe the cave network in its entirety exists on multiple lines. So we seek a crossroads. Tell me, what is this? He indicated something on one of the maps that a younger Gansey had heavily notated. Older Gansey lifted Mallory's finger to look beneath it. Spruce Knob, highest peak in West Virginia. 4,500 feet or something like that. Highest peak in Virginia? Echoed Mallory. West, said Gansey and Adam at the same time. West Virginia, Gansey repeated, studiously avoiding eye contact with another slowing driver. 60 miles west of here. 70, perhaps? Mallory dragged his square fingertip a few inches along one of the many short highlighter paths. And what's this? Cooper's Mountain. Mallory tapped it. What's this note? Giant's Grave? It's another name for the mountain. The professor raised his hairy eyebrows. Interesting name for the new world. Gansey recalled how excited he had been to learn Cooper's Mountain's old name. It had felt like a stunning bit of detective work to stumble across it in an old court document, and then it had been even more thrilling to discover that the mountain was appropriately odd, situated all by itself in the middle of sloping fields, 2 miles away from the main ridge. Why is it interesting? Adam asked. Gansey explained. Kings were often giants in British mythology. A lot of British locations associated with kings have the word giant in them, or are giant-sized. There's a mountain in Wales. What is it? Idris? Dr. Mallory, help me. Mallory smacked his lips.
Cadia Idris.
Right. It translates to the chair of Idris, who was a king and a giant, and so the chair in the mountain is giant-sized, too. I got permission to hike on Giant's Grave. There was some rumor of Native American graves on there, but I couldn't find them. No cave either. Mallory continued tracing the highlighter line. And this? Mole Hill. Used to be a volcano. It's out in the middle of a flat field. No cave there either, but lots of geology students. Mallory tapped on the last location on the line. And this is us, yes?
Mass are not 10.
My, this line of yours, I've waited a lifetime to see something like it. Remarkable. Tell me, there must be others prowling around poking at it as well?
Yes, Adam replied immediately. Gansey looked at him. The yes had left no place for doubt. A yes not of paranoia, but observation. In a lower voice, for Gansey, not Mallory, Adam said, because of Mr. Gray. Of course, Mr. Gray had come looking for a magical parcel, and when he'd failed to deliver it to his employer, Colin Greenmantle, Greenmantle had flooded the town with people looking for Mr. Gray. It would be foolish to assume they'd all left. Gansey preferred to be foolish.
Unsurprising, Mallory concluded. He clapped a hand on Gansey's shoulder. Lucky for both of you that this young man has a better ear than most. He'll hear that king long before anyone else has thought to even listen. Now, let us flee this coarse place before it rubs off. Here, to Spruce Knob, by way of these other two lumps.
Out of old habit, Gansey gathered up the transit and GPS and laser rod as Mallory climbed into the Suburban to wait. Adam went into the woods a bit farther to pee, an action that always made Gansey wish that he was not too inhibited to do the same. When he returned, Adam said suddenly, "I'm glad we're not fighting. It was stupid for it to go on so long."
"Yes," Gansey replied, trying not to sound relieved, exhausted, pleased. He was afraid to say too much. He'd destroy this moment, which already felt imaginary.
Adam continued, "That thing with blue. I should have known it would be weird trying to date her once she was one of, you know, with us all, whatever."
Gansey thought of his fingers on Blue's and how foolish such a gesture had been. This equilibrium was so hard won. He preferred being foolish.
but he couldn't keep on that way. Both boys looked out through the bare spot in the trees toward the valley. Thunder rumbled somewhere, though there was not a cloud in the sky. It didn't feel like it came from the sky anyway. It felt like it came from below them, down in the ley line. Adam's expression was ferocious and pleased. Gansey was at once proud to know him and uncertain he did it all. "I can't believe we're doing this," Gansey said. Adam replied, "I can." 6. This was not Blue's real life. As she leaned against the wall outside the guidance counselor's office, she wondered when she would start to think of school as an important thing again. After an extraordinary summer full of chasing kings and disappearing mothers, it was hard to really, truly picture herself going to class every day. What would any of this matter in 2 years? Nobody here would remember her, or vice versa. She would only remember that this was the fall her mother vanished. This was the year of Glendower. She peered across the linoleum-basted hall to the clock. In an hour, she could walk back home to her real life. "You are coming back tomorrow," Blue told herself, "and the next day." But it felt like more of a dream than Cabe's water. She touched her palm with the fingers of her other hand and thought about that flag Mallory had found, painted with three women with red hands and her face. She thought about how the boys were off exploring without her. She became aware of Noah's presence. At first, she just sort of knew that he was there, and when she considered how it was that she happened to know, she realized she could see him slouching beside her in his rumpled Aglenby uniform. "Here?" Blue demanded, though really she was pleased. "Here, and not in the Raven Cave of Death?" Noah shrugged, apologetic and smudgy. His proximity chilled Blue as he pulled energy from her to stay visible. He blinked at two girls who walked by pushing a cart. They didn't seem to notice him, but it was difficult to tell if it was because he was invisible to them or just because he was Noah. "I think I miss this part," he said, "the beginning. This is the beginning, right?" "First day," Blue replied. "Oh, yeah," Noah leaned back and inhaled. "Oh, wait, no, it's the other one. I forgot. I actually hate this part." Blue did not hate it, because that would require acknowledging that it was really happening. "What are you doing?" Noah asked. She handed him a brochure, even though she felt self-conscious sharing it, as if she were giving him a list for Santa Claus. "Talking to the counselor about that." Noah read the words as if they were in a foreign language. "Experience diverse for wrist types in the Amazon. The school for ecology features a study abroad." "Oh, you can't go somewhere." She was very aware that he was probably right. "Thanks for the vote of confidence. People are going to see you talking to nobody and think you're weird." This amused him. It neither amused nor worried Blue. She'd gone through 18 years as the town psychic's daughter, and now in her senior year, she'd already held every single possible conversation about that fact. She had been shunned and embraced and bullied and cajoled. She was going to hell. She had the straight line to spiritual nirvana. Her mother was a hack. Her mother was a witch. Blue dressed like a hobo. Blue dressed like a fashion mogul. She was untouchably hilarious. She was a friendless bitch. It had faded into monotonous background noise. The disheartening and lonesome upshot was that Blue Sargent was the strangest thing in the halls of Mountain View High School. Well, with the exception of Noah. "Do you see other dead people?" Blue asked him, meaning, "Do you see my mother?" Noah shuddered. A voice came from the cracked office door. "Blue, sweetie, you can come in now." Noah slid into the office ahead of her. Even though he looked solid and living in the strong sunlight through the office window, the counselor looked right through him. His invisibility seemed downright miraculous as he sat down on the floor in front of the metal desk to pleasantly eavesdrop. Blue shot him a withering look. There were two sorts of people, the ones who could see Noah and the ones who couldn't. Blue generally only got along with the former. The counselor, Ms. Schiftlet, was new to the school, but not to Henrietta. Blue recognized her from the post office. She was one of those impeccably dressed older women who liked things done right the first time. She sat perfectly straight in a chair designed for slouching, out of place behind a cheap shared desk cluttered with mismatching personal knick-knacks. Ms. Schiftlet efficiently checked the computer. "I see someone just had a birthday." "It was your birthday?" Noah demanded. Blue struggled to address the counselor instead of Noah. "What? Oh, yes." It had been 2 weeks ago. Ordinarily, Mara made sludgy brownies, but she hadn't been there. Persephone had tried her best to recreate their undercooked glory, but the brownies had accidentally turned out pretty and precise with powdered sugar dusted in lace patterns on top. Calla had seemed worried Blue would be angry, which bemused Blue. Why would Blue be angry at them? It was Mara she wanted to slap. Or hug. "I can't believe you didn't tell us," muttered Noah. "We could have gone for gelato." Noah couldn't eat, but he liked the gelato parlor in town for reasons that escaped Blue. Ms. Schiftlet inclined her head to Blue without disrupting her perfect posture. "I see here you talked to Mr. Torres before he left. He has a note here about an incident in..." "That's all taken care of and done with," Blue interrupted, avoiding Noah's eyes. She slid the brochure across the desk. "Pretend like it never happened. All I'd like to know is if there's any way to get here from what I'm doing now." Ms. Schiftlet was visibly eager to get off the topic of anything that could be considered an incident. She consulted the brochure. "Well, this looks like a barrel of monkeys, pun intended. Do you have an interest in wildlife? Let me pull up some information on the school." Noah leaned over. "You should see her shoes. Pointy." Blue ignored him. "I'd like to do something with river systems or forest." "Oh, this school is very competitive." Miss Schiftlet was too efficient to let Blue finish her sentence. "Here, let me show you the average scores of the students who get accepted." "Rude," Noah commented. Miss Schiftlet turned the monitor so that Blue could see a somewhat demoralizing graph. "You see how few students get accepted. That means financial aid would also be very competitive. You'd be applying for aid." She said it like a statement instead of a question, but she wasn't wrong. This was Mountain View High. No one was paying outright for a private school. Most of Blue's peers considered community college or state schools, if they considered college at all. "I don't know if Mr. Torres went over the types of schools you need." Ms. Schiftlet sounded as if she suspected he hadn't and that she judged him for it. "What you need is three different types: reach schools, match schools, and safety schools. This one is a wonderful example of a reach school, but now it's time to add some others to your list. Some schools that you can be sure you can get into and afford. That's just good sense." Ms. Schiftlet wrote reach, match, and safety on an index card. Underlining safety, she slid it across the desk. Blue wasn't sure if she was supposed to keep it. "Have you filled out your application fee waiver form?" "Four of them. I read online I could get up to four waived." This show of efficiency visibly pleased Ms. Schiftlet. "So maybe you already know this is your reach school. Now it's time to make a sensible backup plan." Blue was so tired of compromises. She was tired of sensible. Noah scratched his fingernails on the desk leg. The sound, which was admittedly uncomfortable, made Ms. Schiftlet frown. He said, "I'd be way more sunshiny if I was a counselor." "If I did get in," Blue said, "could I get loans and aid to cover it all?" "Let me get you some paperwork," Ms. Schiftlet said. "FAFSA will pay for a percentage depending on your need. The amount varies." Blue couldn't expect any help from the lean budget at 300 Fox Way. She thought about the bank account she'd slowly been filling. "How much will be left over? Could you guess?" Ms. Schiftlet sighed. Guessing clearly fell outside her realm of interests. She flipped the monitor around again to reveal the school's tuition rate. "If you were staying in the dorm, you'd probably be obligated for $10,000 a year. Your parents could take out a loan, of course. I have paperwork for that, too, if you would like it. Blue leaned back as her heart vacated her chest cavity. Of course it was impossible. It had been impossible before she arrived, and would continue being impossible forever. It was just that spending time with Gansey and the others had made her think that the impossible might be more possible than she'd thought before. Mora was always telling her, look at all the potential you hold inside yourself. Potential for other people, though, not for Blue. It wasn't worth shedding tears over something she had known for so long. It was just that this, on top of everything else, she swallowed. I will not cry in front of this woman. Suddenly, Noah scrambled out from under the desk. He leapt to his feet. There was something wrong about the action, something about it that meant it was too fast or too vertical or too violent for a living boy to perform. And he kept going up even after he'd already stood. As he stretched to the ceiling, the card that said reach, match, and safety hurtled into the air. Oh, said Ms. Shiflet. Her voice wasn't even surprised yet. The warmth sucked from Blue's skin. The water in Ms. Shiflet's glass creaked. The business card holder upended. Cards splayed across the desk. A computer speaker fell onto its face. An array of paper swirled up. Someone's family photo shot upward. Blue jumped up. She didn't have any immediate plan but to stop Noah, but as she flung her hands out, she realized that Noah wasn't there. There was just a tossed explosion of tissues and business envelopes and business cards, a frenetic tornado losing propulsion. The material collapsed back to the desk. Blue and Ms. Shiflet stared at each other. The paper rustled as it settled completely. The knocked-over computer speaker buzzed. One of its cables had been knocked ajar. The temperature was slowly rising in the room again. What just happened? Ms. Shiflet asked. Blue's pulse galloped. Truthfully, she replied, I have no idea. 7. Blue arrived at Monmouth Manufacturing before anyone else. She knocked to be sure and then let herself in. Immediately she was enveloped with the comfortable scent of the room, the faded library smell of old books, the cool odor of mint, the must and rust scent of century-old brick and ancient pipes, the note of funk from the heap of dirty laundry against the wall. Noah? Her voice was small in the huge expanse. She dropped her backpack on the desk chair. Are you here? It's okay, I'm not upset. You can use my energy if you need. There was no answer. The space was turning gray and blue as one of the strange flash thunderstorms roiled over the mountains, filling the floor-to-ceiling windows of the warehouse with clouds. The sharp afternoon shadows behind the stacks of books mutated and diffused. The room felt heavy, sleepy. Blue peered into the dark gathering at the far above peak of the roof. Noah, I just want to talk about what happened. She put her head in the door of Noah's room. Mallory's things occupied it currently, and it smelled mannish and evergreen. One of his bags was open, and Blue could see that it was entirely filled with books. This struck her as impractical and Gansey-like and made her feel a bit more benevolent toward the professor. Noah was not there. She checked the bathroom, which was also sort of the laundry room and kitchen. The doors hung open on a small stacked washer-dryer unit, socks draped over the sink's edge, either drying or flung. A small fridge lurked dangerously close to the toilet. A length of rubber tubing strangled a shower head above a grimy drain. The shower curtain was strung from the ceiling with fishing line. Blue was disturbed by the number of chip bags that were reachable from the toilet. A dark red tie on the floor pointed a jagged line toward the exit. Some foreign impulse urged Blue to pick up any of the mess, any single component to improve upon the disaster. She did not. She backed out. Ronan's room was forbidden, but she looked inside anyway. His raven's cage sat with its door ajar, impeccably and incongruously clean. His room was filled not so much with filth, but clutter. Shovels and swords leaned in the corners, speakers and printers piled by the wall, and bizarre objects in between, an old suitcase with vines trailing out of it, a potted tree that seemed to be humming to itself, a single cowboy boot in the middle of the floor. A mask hung high on the wall, eyes wide, mouth gaping. It was blackened as if by fire, and the edges were badly bitten as if by a saw. Something that looked suspiciously like a tire track ran over one of its eyes. The mask made Blue think of words like survivor and destroyer. She didn't like it. A crash behind Blue made her leap, but it was only the apartment door opening. Guilt had amplified the sound. Blue darted out of Ronan's room. Ganzi and Mallory trailed in slowly, deep in conversation. The dog sulked behind them, excluded by virtue of not speaking English. Of course, Yolo Gok would make sense as a companion, Ganzi was saying, sloughing off his jacket. Him or Griffith Lloyd, I suppose. But, no, it's impossible. He died in Wales. But are we sure, Mallory asked, do we know where he was buried, that he was buried? Or if he was just made into nightgowns, you mean? Ganzi caught sight of Blue then, and he rewarded her with his best smile. Not his polished one, but the more foolish number that meant he was excited. Hello, Jane. Tell me what Yolo Gok means to you. Blue pulled her thoughts from Ronan's mask and Noah in school. A chest cold? Glendower's closest poet, Ganzi corrected. Also very funny. Did you find anything? She asked. Absolutely nothing, he replied, but he sounded cheerful about it. Mallory lowered his mask onto the leather couch. The dog lay on top of him. It didn't seem as if it would be very comfortable. The dog draped over the professor like a slip cloth over a chair. But Mallory merely closed his eyes and stroked him in an uncharacteristic show of affection.
Ganzi, I perish for a cup of tea. Can such a thing be had in this place? I cannot possibly hope to survive this jet lag without a cup of tea.
I got tea just for you, Ganzi said. I'll make some.
Please, not with loo water, Mallory called after him, not opening his eyes. The dog kept lying on him.
For an overwhelming moment, Blue was afraid she was going to be unable to prevent herself from asking what the dog was for. Instead, she followed Ganzi back to the kitchen bathroom laundry. He rummaged through the cluttered shelves.
We were just talking about the mechanics of bringing Glendower over here. The books say he traveled with mages. Are they the ones who put him to sleep? Did he want it? Was he sleeping before he left, or did he fall asleep here?
It suddenly seemed like a lonesome thing to be buried a sea away from your home, like being shot off into space.
Yolo Gok was one of the mages?
No, just a poet. You heard Mallory in the car. They were very poet-litical. Poet. Political. Ganzi laughed at his own stumble. Poets were political. I know that's not really a tongue twister. I've been listening to Mallory all day.
P-p-political? Poets.
Yolo composed these really flattering poems about Glendower's past prowess and his house and lands, his family and such. Oh, what am I even looking for here? He paused to locate a tiny microwave. He examined the interior of a mug before filling it. Pulling a mint leaf from his pocket to suck on, he spoke around it as the water heated. Really, if Glendower were Robin Hood, Yolo Gok would have been that other guy.
Maid Marian, Blue said. Little John.
Ganzi pointed at her. Like Batman and Robin, but he died in Wales.
Are we to believe he returned to Wales after leaving Glendower here?
No, I reject it. Blue loved this ponderous, scholarly Ganzi, too involved with facts to consider how he appeared on the outside.
She asked, Glendower had a wife, right?
Died in the Tower of London.
Siblings?
Beheaded.
Children?
A million of them, but most imprisoned and dead, or just plain dead. He lost his entire family in the uprising.
Poet it is, then.
Ganzi asked, have you ever heard the rumor that if you boil water in the microwave, it will explode when you touch it?
Has to be pure, she replied. Distilled water.
Regular water won't explode because of the minerals. You shouldn't believe everything you read on the internet.
A roaring sound interrupted them, sudden and complete.
Blue started, but Ganzi just cast his eyes upward. It's rain on the roof. Must be dumping.
He turned, mug in hand, and suddenly they were an inch apart.
She could smell the mint in his mouth. She saw his throat move as he swallowed. She was furious at her body for betraying her, for warning him differently than any of the other boys, for refusing to listen to her insistence that they were just friends. "How was your first day of school, Jane?" he asked, voice different than before. "Mom's gone," Noah exploded. "I'm not going to college. I don't want to go home where everything is strange, and I don't want to go back to school where everything is normal." "Oh, you know, public school," she said, not meeting his eyes. She concentrated instead on Gansey's neck, which was right at eye level, and on how his collar didn't lay quite flat against his skin all the way around because of his Adam's apple. "We just watched cartoons all day." She'd meant it to be wry, but she didn't think it quite worked. "We'll find her," he said, and her chest twinged again. "I don't know if she wants to be found." "Fair enough. Jane, if..." He stopped and swirled the tea. "I hope Mallory doesn't want any milk. I completely forgot." She wished she could still evoke that Blue who despised him. She wished she knew if Adam would feel terrible about this. She wished she knew if fighting this feeling would make Gansey's foretold end destroy her any less. She shut the microwave. Gansey left the room. Back on the sofa, Mallory viewed the tea as a man would view a death sentence. "What else?" Gansey asked kindly. Mallory shoved the dog off him. "I'd like a new hip and better weather. However, this is your home, and I know that I'm an outsider, so far be it from me to chastise or generally overstep. That being said, were you aware there was someone under?" He indicated the storm-dark area beneath the pool table. If Blue squinted, she could make out a form in the black. "Noah," Gansey said, "come out at once." "No," Noah replied. "Well, I see you two know each other, and all is well," Mallory said, in the voice of someone who sensed trouble coming and hadn't brought an umbrella. "I will be in my room nursing my jet lag." After he had retreated, Blue said with exasperation, "Noah, I called and called for you." Noah remained where he was, arms hugged around his body. He looked markedly less alive than he had earlier. There was something smudgy about his eyes, something uncertain about his edges. It was kind of hard to look at the place where Noah stopped and the shadow below him began. Something unpleasant happened in Blue's throat when she tried to make out what was off about his face. "I'm tired of it," Noah said. "Tired of what?" Gansey asked, voice kind. "Decaying." He had been crying. That was what was wrong with his face, Blue realized. Nothing supernatural. "Oh, Noah," she said, crouching down. "What can I do?" Gansey asked. "We, what can we do?" Noah shrugged in a watery way. Blue was suddenly desperately afraid that Noah might want to actually die. This seemed like something most ghosts wanted, to be laid to rest. It was a dreadful notion, a forever goodbye. Her selfishness warred mightily with every bit of ethics she had ever learned from the women of her family. "Blast!" She had to. She asked, "Do you want us to find a way to lay? Before she'd even finished, Noah started shaking his head. He hugged his legs closer. "No, no, no, no." "You don't have to be ashamed," Blue said, because it sounded like what her mother would have said. She was certain her mother would have added something comforting about the afterlife, but she was unable this time to sound comforting when she herself wanted to be comforted. Lamely, she finished, "You don't have to be afraid." "You don't know," Noah said, vaguely hysterical. "You don't know." She stretched out a hand. "Okay, hey," Noah repeated, "you don't know." "We can talk this out," Gansey said, as if a decaying soul was something that could be solved through conversation. "You don't know, you don't know." Noah was standing. It was impossible, because there was not room beneath the pool table for him to stand. But he was somehow escaping on either side, surrounding Gansey and Blue. The maps fluttered frantically against the green surface. A flock of dust wads tumbled from beneath the table and raced down the streets of Gansey's miniature model of Henrietta. The desk lamp flickered. The temperature dropped. Blue saw Gansey's eyes widen behind a cloud of his own breath. Noah? Blue warned. Her head felt swimmy as Noah robbed her of energy. She caught a whiff, strangely, of the old carpet smell of the guidance counselor's office, and then the living green scent of Cabe's water. This isn't you. The swirl of wind was still rising, flapping papers and knocking over stacks of books. The dog was barking from behind the closed door of Noah's old room. Goosebumps rippled on Blue's skin, and her limbs felt heavy. Noah, stop, Gansey said, but he didn't. The door to the apartment rattled. Blue said, Noah, I'm asking you now. He wasn't attending, or there wasn't enough of the true Noah to attend. Standing up on her wobbly legs, Blue began to use all of the protective visualization she'd been taught by her mother. She imagined herself inside an unbreakable glass ball. She could see out, but no one could touch her. She imagined white light piercing the stormy clouds, the roof, the darkness of Noah, finding Blue, armoring her. Then she pulled the plug on the battery that was Blue Sargent. The room went still. The papers settled. The light flickered once more and then strengthened. She heard a little gasp of a sob and then absolute quiet. Gansey looked shocked. Noah sat in the middle of the floor, papers all around him, a mint plant spilling dirt by his hand. He was all hunched over and shadowless, his form slight and streaky, barely visible at all. He was crying again. In a very small voice, he told Blue, You said I could use your energy. She knelt in front of him. She wanted to hug him, but he wasn't really there. Without her energy, he was a paper-thin boy. He was a skull. He was air in the shape of Noah. Not like that. He whispered, I'm sorry. Me too. He covered his face, and then he was gone. Gansey said, That was impressive, Jane. 8. That night, Blue leaned against the spreading beech tree in her backyard. Her eyes cast up to the stars, and her fingers touching the chilly, smooth bark of one of the roots. The kitchen light through the sliding door seemed far away. That was impressive, Jane. Although Blue was perfectly aware of the positive effects of her ability, she had never really considered the opposite. And yet, Noah would have destroyed Monmouth Manufacturing if she hadn't cut herself off from him. The stars winked through the beech leaves. She'd read that new stars tended to form in pairs, binary stars, orbiting in close proximity, only becoming single stars when their partner was smashed off them by another pair of wildly spinning new stars. If she pretended hard enough, she could see the multitude of pairs clinging to each other in the destructive and creative gravity of their constellations. Impressive. Maybe she was a little impressed. Not by pulling the plug on a dead boy. That seemed sad, nothing to brag about. But because she'd learned something about herself today, and she'd thought there was nothing left there to discover. The stars moved slowly above her, an array of possibilities, and for the first time in a long time, she felt them mirrored in her heart. Calla opened the sliding door. Blue? What?
If you're done gallivanting for the day, I could use your body. Calla said. I have a reading.
Blue raised her eyebrows. Mora only asked for her help during important readings, and Calla never asked, period. Curiosity rather than obedience pulled Blue to her feet. This late? Now?
I'm asking now, aren't I?
Once inside, Calla fussed over the reading room and called for Persephone so many times that Orla screamed back that some people were trying to conduct phone calls, and Jimmy shouted, Is it something I can help with? All of the fuss made Blue strangely nervous. At 300 Fox Way, readings happened so often that they ordinarily felt both perfunctory and unmagical. But this felt like chaos. This felt like anything could happen. The doorbell rang.
Persephone, I told you, Calla roared. Blue, get that. I'll be in the reading room. Bring him in there.
When Blue opened the front door, she discovered an Aglinby student standing in the glow of the porch light. Moths fluttered around his head. He wore salmon-colored pants and white topsiders and boasted flawless skin and tousled hair. Then her eyes adjusted, and she realized that he was too old to be a raven boy. Quite a bit too old. It was hard to imagine how she would have thought it before, even for a moment. Blue scowled at his shoes and then at his face. Although everything about him had been cultivated to impress, she found him less impressive than she might have a few months before. "Hola."
"Howdy," he replied, with a cheery smile full of unsurprisingly straight teeth. "I'm here for a probing of my future. I expect the timing is still good."
"You expect right, sailor. Come in." In the reading room, Calla had been joined by Persephone. They sat on one side of the table like a jury. The man stood across from them, idly drumming his fingers on a chair back.
"Sit," intoned Calla.
"Any old chair," Persephone added mildly.
"Not any old chair," Calla said. She pointed. "That one."
He sat opposite, his bright eyes all over the room as he did, his body dynamic. He looked like a person who got things done. Blue couldn't decide if he was handsome or if his demeanor was fooling her into believing him so. He asked,
"Well, how does this work? Do I pay you up front, or do you decide how much it is after you see how complicated my future is?"
"Any old time," Persephone said.
"No," Calla said. "Now, 50.
He parted with the bills without malice.
"Could I get a receipt? Business expense. That is a fantastic portrait of Steve Martin over there, by the way. Behold how its eyes follow you around the room."
"Blue, would you get the receipt?" Persephone asked.
Blue, lingering by the door, went for a business card to write the amount on. When she returned, Persephone was saying to Calla,
"Oh, we will have to use just yours. I don't have mine."
"Don't have yours?" Calla replied incredulously. "What happened to them?"
"Coca-Cola shirt has them."
With a mighty snort, Calla retrieved her tarot cards and instructed the man on how to shuffle them. She finished.
"Then you pass them back to me face down and I'll draw them."
He began.
"As you shuffle them, you should be thinking about what you'd like to know,"
Persephone added in her small voice.
"That will focus the reading quite a bit."
"Good, good,"
he replied, shuffling the cards more aggressively. He glanced up at Blue.
Then without warning, he flipped the deck so that the cards were face up.
He fanned them out, eyes darting over the selection. This was not how Calla had instructed him. Something in Blue's nerves tingled a warning.
"So, if the question is, how can I make this happen?"
He plucked the card free and set it on the table. "That's a good start, right?" There was dead silence. The card was the Three of Swords. It depicted a bloody heart stabbed with the aforementioned three swords. Gore dripped down the blades. Mora called it the heartbreak card. Blue needed no psychic perception to feel the threat oozing from it. The psychics stared at the man. With a cool curl in her stomach, Blue realized that they hadn't seen this coming.
Calla growled, "What's your game?"
He kept smiling his cheery, congenial smile.
"Here's the question. Is there another one of you? One that looks more like that one?"
He pointed at Blue, whose stomach turned over unpleasantly once more.
"Mom."
"Go to hell,"
Calla burst out. He nodded.
"That's what I thought. You expecting her anytime soon?
I'd love to have a chat with her in particular."
"Hell,"
Persephone said.
"I actually agree in this case, insofar as going there is concerned."
"What does this man want with Mom?" Blue frantically memorized everything about him so that she could describe him later. The man stood, sweeping up the Three of Swords.
"You know what? I'm keeping this. Thanks for the info."
As he turned to go, Calla started after him, but Persephone put a single finger on Calla's arm, stopping her.
"No,"
Persephone said softly. The front door closed.
"That one's not to be touched."
9.
Adam was reading and rereading his first quarter schedule when Ronan hurled himself into the desk beside him. They were the only two in the navy-carpeted classroom. Adam had arrived very early to Borden House. It seemed wrong that the first day of school should carry the same emotional weight as the anxious afternoon in the Cave of Ravens, but there was no denying that the gleeful and anticipatory jitter in his veins now was as pronounced as those breathless minutes when birds sang around them. One more year, and he had done it. The first day was the easiest, of course, before it had really all begun. The homework and the sports, the school-wide dinners and the college counseling, the exams and the extra credit. Before Adam's night job and studying until 3 a.m. conspired to destroy him. He read his schedule again. It bristled with classes and extracurriculars. It looked impossible. Aglenby was a hard school. Harder for Adam, though, because he had to be the best. Last year, Barrington Welk had stood at the front of this room and taught them Latin. Now he was dead. Adam knew that he had seen Welk die, but he couldn't seem to remember what the event had actually looked like, though he could, if he tried hard enough, imagine what it should have looked like. Adam closed his eyes for a moment. In the quiet of the empty classroom, he could hear the rustling of leaves against yet more leaves.
"I can't take it," Ronan said.
Adam opened his eyes. "Take what?"
"Take sitting, apparently." Ronan went to the whiteboard and began to write. He had furious handwriting.
"Mallory, he's always complaining about his hips or his eyes or the government or, oh, and that dog. It's not like he's blind or crippled or anything."
"Why couldn't he have something normal, like a raven?"
Ronan ignored this.
"And he got up 3 times in the night to piss. I think he has a tumor."
Adam said, "You don't sleep anyway."
"Not anymore."
Ronan's dry erase marker squeaked in protest as he jabbed down Latin words.
Although Ronan wasn't smiling and Adam didn't know some of the vocabulary, Adam was certain it was a dirty joke. For a moment he watched Ronan and tried to imagine that he was a teacher instead of a Ronan. It was impossible. Adam couldn't decide if it was how he'd shoved up his sleeves or the apocalyptic way he had tied his tie.
"He knows everything," Ronan said in a casual way.
Adam didn't immediately reply, though he knew what Ronan meant, because he also found the professor's omniscience uncomfortable. When he thought harder about the source of the unpleasantness, the idea of Mallory spending a year with 15-year-old Gansey, he had to admit that it was not paranoia, but jealousy. "He's older than I expected," Adam said.
"Oh, God, the oldest," Ronan replied at once, as if he had been waiting for Adam to mention it. "He never chews with his mouth shut."
A floorboard popped. Immediately, Ronan put down his marker. One couldn't open the front door of Borden House without making the floor creak 2 rooms over. So both boys knew what the noise meant. School was underway.
"Well," Ronan said, sounding nasty and unhappy, "here we go, cowboy."
Returning to his desk, he threw his feet up on it. This was forbidden, of course. He crossed his arms, tilted his chin back, closed his eyes. Instant insolence. This was the version of himself he prepared for Aglenby, for his older brother Declan, and sometimes for Gansey. Ronan was always saying that he never lied, but he wore a liar's face. In the students came. It was such a familiar sound, desk legs scraping the floor, jackets swooshing over chair backs, notebooks slapping worktops, that Adam could have closed his eyes and still seen the scene with perfect clarity. They were chattering and hateful and oblivious.
"Where have you been on break, man?"
"Cape always, where else?"
"So boring, Vale. Mom broke her ankle."
"Oh, you know, we did Europe, hobo style."
"Granddad said I needed to get some muscles because I was looking gay these days."
"No, he didn't really say that. Speaking of which, here's Parrish."
Someone cuffed the back of Adam's head. He blinked up, one way, then the other. His assailant had come up on Adam's deaf side.
"Oh," Adam said. It was Tad Carruthers, whose worst fault was that Adam didn't like him and Tad couldn't tell.
"Oh," mimicked Tad benevolently, as if Adam's standoffishness charmed him. Adam wanted desperately and masochistically for Tad to ask him where he had summered.
Instead, Tad turned to where Ronan was still reclined with his eyes closed. He lifted a hand to cuff Ronan's head, but lost his nerve an inch into the swing. Instead, he just drummed on Ronan's desk and moved off. Adam could feel the pulse of the ley line in the veins of his hands. The students kept coming in. Adam kept watching. He was good at this part, the observing of others. It was himself that he couldn't seem to study or understand. How he despised them. How he wanted to be them. How pointless to summer in Maine. How much he wanted to do it. How affected he found their speech. How he coveted their lazy monotones. He couldn't tell how all of these things could be equally true. Gansey appeared in the doorway. He was speaking to a teacher in the hall, thumb poised on his lower lip, eyebrows furrowed handsomely, uniform worn with confident ease. He stepped into the classroom, shoulders square, and for just a second, it was like he was a stranger again. Once more, that lofty, unknowable Virginia princeling. It hit Adam like a real thing, like somehow he had stopped being friends with Gansey and forgotten until this moment. Like Gansey would take a seat on the other side of Ronan instead of the one by Adam. Like the last year had not happened, and once more it would be just Adam against all the rest of these overfed predators. Then Gansey sat down in the seat in front of Adam with a sigh. He turned around. "Jesus Christ, I haven't slept a second." He remembered his manners and extended his fist. As Adam bumped knuckles with him, he felt an extraordinary rush of relief, of fondness. "Ronan, feet down." Ronan put his feet down. Gansey turned back to Adam. "Ronan told you all about the pig, then?"
"Ronan told me nothing." "I told you about the pissing," Ronan said.
Adam ignored him.
"What about the car?"
Gansey glanced around at Borden House as if he expected to see that it had changed over the summer. Of course it had not. Navy carpet over everything, baseboard heating on too early in the year, bookshelves crowded with elegantly tattered books in Latin and Greek and French. It was your favorite aunt who smelled when you hugged her. "Last night we went out for bread and jam and more tea in the pig, and the power steering went out. Then the radio, the lights. Jesus. Ronan was singing that awful murder squash song the whole damn time, and he only made it through half a verse before I had absolutely nothing. Had to wrestle it out of the road."
"Alternator again," Adam observed.
"Right, yes, yes," Gansey said. "I opened up the hood and saw the alternator belt just hanging there ragged. We had to go get another one, and it was just an absolute zoo to find one in stock for some reason, like there was a run on this precise size. Of course, putting on the new belt by the side of the road was the fast part." He said it in the most offhanded way, like it was nothing to have thrown on a new belt, but once upon a not very long time ago, Richard Gansey III had only one automotive skill, calling a tow truck. Adam said, "You were smart to figure it out."
"Oh, I don't know," Gansey replied, but it was clear he was proud. Adam felt like he had helped a bird hatch from an egg. "Thank God we're not fighting. Thank God we're not fighting. Thank God we're not fighting. How can I keep it from happening again?"
Ronan said, "Keep it up and you just might be a mechanic after you graduate. They'll put that in the alumni magazine."
"Ha, and?" Gansey swiveled in his seat to watch as the new Latin teacher made his way to the front. Every student watched him. In his glove box, Adam kept a cutout advertisement for Inspiration. The photo featured a sleek gray car made by Happy Germans. A young man leaned against the vehicle in a long coat of black virgin wool, collar turned up against the wind. He was confident and snub-nosed, like a powerful child, with lots of dark hair and white teeth. His arms were crossed over his chest like a prize fighter. That was what their new Latin teacher looked like. Adam was badly impressed. The new teacher swept his dark coat off as he observed Ronan's handiwork on the whiteboard. Then he turned his gaze on the seated students with the same confidence as the man in the car advertisement.
"Well, look at you," he said. His eyes lingered on Gansey, on Adam, on Ronan. "America's youth.
I can't decide if you are the best or the worst thing I've seen this week. Whose work is this?
Everyone knew, but no one copped to it.
He clasped his hands behind his back and took a closer look. Vocabulary is impressive.
He tapped a knuckle against a few of the words. He was kinetic.
But what's going on with the grammar in here and here? You'd want a subjunctive here in this fear clause. I fear that they may believe this. There should be a vocative here.
I know what's being said here because I already know the joke, but a native speaker would have just stared at you. This is not usable Latin.
Adam didn't have to turn his head to feel Ronan simmering. Their new Latin teacher turned, swift and compact and keen, and again Adam felt that rush of both intimidation and awe.
Good thing, too, or I'd be out of a job.
Well, you little runts, gentlemen, I'm your Latin teacher for the year. I'm not really a fan of languages for the sake of languages. I'm only interested in how we can use them. And I'm not really a Latin teacher. I'm a historian. That means I'm really only interested in Latin as a mechanism to rifle through dead men's papers. Any questions?
The students eyed him. This was the first period of the first day of school, and nothing could make Latin class less full of Latin. This man's fervent energy sank uselessly into moss-covered stones.
Adam put up his hand. The man pointed at him. Miserere nobis, Adam said. Timeo nos horrendi esse,
sir.
Have mercy on us. I'm afraid we are terrible.
The man's smile widened at sir, but he had to know that students were to address teachers as sir or madam to show respect.
Nihil timeo, he replied. Soliter ambulando.
The nuances of his first statement, I fear nothing, escaped most of the class, and the second statement, an idiom embracing the merit of practice, blew by the rest. Ronan smiled lazily. Without raising his hand, he said,
Heh, noli prohicere macaritas ad porcos.
Don't throw pearls before swine. He did not add, sir.
Are you pigs, then? The man asked. Or are you men?
Adam wasn't eager to watch either Ronan or their new Latin teacher run out to the end of their respective ropes. He asked quickly,
Quod nomen est tibi, sir?
My name, the man swept out a big swath of Ronan's bad grammar with the edge of an eraser and used the space to replace it with efficient letters of his own, is Colin Greenmantle.
10.
Here we are, living among the provincials. Colin Greenmantle leaned out the window. Down below, a herd of cows looked up at him. Piper, come look at these cows. This one asshole is looking right at me. Colin, says this cow, you are really living among the provincials now.
Piper said, I'm in the bath.
Her voice was coming from the kitchen, though. His wife, although he didn't like to use that word, wife, because it made him think that he was now over 30, which he was, but still, he didn't need to be reminded. And anyway, he still had his boyish good looks. In fact, the cashier at the grocery store had flirted with him just last night, and even though it could have been the fact that he was overawingly overdressed for a cheesecracker run, he thought it was probably his aquamarine eyes, because she had been virtually swimming in them, was taking the move to Henrietta better than he had expected. So far, the only act of rebellion Piper had performed had been to wreck the rental car by driving it aggressively through a shopping center sign to demonstrate just how unsuited she was for living in a place where she couldn't walk to shops. It was possible she hadn't done it on purpose, but there was very little Piper did by accident.
They are basically monsters, Greenmantle said, although now he was thinking less of the cows and more of his new pupils. Accepting handouts all day long, but they'd eat you in a second if they had the right teeth for it.
They'd only just moved into their historic rental on a cattle farm. Greenmantle, who had made plenty of history, doubted the farmhouse's historic claim, but it was charming enough. He liked the idea of farming. In the most basic linguistic sense, he was now a farmer.
"They'll be here for your blood on Friday,"
Piper called. The cows lowed curiously. Greenmantle experimentally flipped them off. Their expressions didn't change.
"They're here now." "Not the cows. I'm getting more life insurance for you, and they need your blood. Friday, be here."
He ducked back inside and creaked down to the kitchen. Piper stood at the counter in a pink bra and underwear, chopping a mango. Her blonde hair was a curtain around her head. She didn't look up. "I'm teaching Friday," he said. "Think of the children. How much life insurance do we need?"
"I have certain standards of living I want to maintain if something terrible happens to you in the middle of the night."
She stabbed at him with the knife as he stole a piece of mango. He avoided a wound only because of his speed, not her lack of intention.
"Just come right back after class. Don't fritter around like you've been doing."
"I'm not frittering," Greenmantle said. "I am being quite purposeful."
"Yes, I know. Getting revenge, having testicles, whatnot."
"You can help if you want. You're so much better with directions and things." She couldn't quite hide that the appeal to her ego pleased her.
"I can't until Sunday. I have eyebrows on Wednesday, bikini line on Thursday. Don't come home on Saturday, fritter on Saturday. I'm having people come sage the house."
Greenmantle swiped another piece of mango. The knife came a little closer this time. "What does that mean?"
"I saw a flyer. It's getting rid of the bad energy in a place. This house is full of it."
"That's just you." She tossed the knife into the sink where it would remain until it died. Piper was not much for housework. She had a very narrow skill set. She drifted toward the bedroom on her way to have a bath or take a nap or start a war.
"Don't get us killed."
"No one's going to kill us," Greenmantle said with certainty. "The gray man knows the rules, and the others..." He rinsed the knife and put it back in the knife block.
"The others what?"
He hadn't realized she was still in the room.
"Oh, I was just thinking about how I saw one of Neil Lynch's sons today." "Was he a bastard too?"
Piper asked. Neil Lynch had been responsible for 7 moderately unpleasant and 4 extremely unpleasant months in their collective lives. "Probably. God, but he looked just like that fucker. I can't wait to fail him. I wonder if he knows who I am. I wonder if I should tell him."
"You are such a sadist," she said carelessly.
He knocked his knuckles on the counter. "I'm going to go see which jaw those cows have teeth on."
"Bottom. I saw it on Animal Planet."
"I'm going anyway." As he tried to remember which door led to the mudroom, he heard her say something to him, but he didn't catch it. He'd already dialed the number of a Belgian contact who was supposed to be looking into a 15th-century belt buckle that gave the wearer bad dreams. It was taking this guy forever to run it down. Too bad he couldn't put the gray man on it. He'd been the best, right up until he'd betrayed Greenmantle, of course. He wondered how long it would take the gray man to come to him. 11. When Ganzi and Ronan arrived at 300 Fox Way after school, Calla was being attacked in the living room by a man dressed entirely in gray. Blue, Persephone, and the furniture lurked against the walls. The man stood in perfect fighting form, legs a little wider than his shoulders, 1 foot forward. He had a solid grip on one of her hands. In Calla's other hand, she held a Manhattan, which she was trying not to spill. The gray man was smiling thinly. He had extraordinary teeth. The boys had entered without knocking, familiarly, and now Ganzi eased his messenger bag to the old buckled floorboards and stood in the doorway to the living room. He wasn't sure if the situation required intervention. The gray man was a, possibly retired, hit man. Nothing to be trifled with. But still, if Calla wanted help, surely she would have put her drink down. Surely Blue would not be merely eating yogurt.
"Show me again," Calla said. "I didn't see it, I don't think."
I'll do it a little harder, Mr. Gray replied, but I don't want to actually break your arm.
You were nowhere close, she assured him. Put your back into it.
She sipped her Manhattan. He clasped her hand and wrist again, his skin pale against hers, and swiftly turned her entire arm. Her shoulder tipped downward sharply. She snatched at her drink and cackled, "That one I felt."
Now do it to me, Mr. Gray said. I'll hold your drink.
Putting his hands in his pockets, Gansey leaned against the door jamb, watching. He knew instinctively that the dreadful news he carried was the sort of burden that would only get heavier once shared. He allowed himself a moment before the storm, letting the atmosphere of the house do its usual work on him. Unlike Monmouth Manufacturing, 300 Fox Way was cramped with extraneous people and whimsical objects. It hummed with conversation, music, telephones, old appliances. It was impossible to forget that all of these women were plugged into the past and tapped into the future, connected to everything in the world and to one another. Gansey didn't so much visit as get absorbed. He loved it. He wanted to be a part of this world, even though he understood there were endless reasons why he could never be. Blue was the natural result of a home like this, confident, strange, credulous, curious. And here he was, neurotic, rarefied, the product of something else entirely.
What else? Cal asked.
I can show you how to unhinge my jaw if you like, Mr. Gray said kindly.
Oh, yes, that. Well, there is Richard Gansey III, Calla said, catching sight of him. And the snake. Where is Coca-Cola?
Work, Gansey said. He couldn't get off. Persephone waved vaguely from behind a tall, light pink drink. Blue didn't wave. She had seen Gansey's expression.
Does the name Colin Greenmantle mean anything to you? Gansey asked Mr. Gray, though he already knew the answer.
Handing Calla her drink, the gray man wiped his palms on his slacks. The excellent teeth had vanished.
Colin Greenmantle was my employer.
He's our new Latin teacher.
Oh, dear, said Persephone. Would you like a drink?
Gansey realized she was talking to him.
Oh, no, thank you. I need another one, she said. I'm making one for you, too, Mr. Gray.
The gray man crossed to the window. His car, an unsubtle white Mitsubishi with an enormous spoiler, was parked outside, and both he and Ronan studied it pensively. After a very long moment, the gray man said, He's the man who asked me to kill Ronan's father. Gansey knew that he could not be hurt by the casualness of the statement. Mr. Gray was a hitman, Neil Lynch had been his mark, he had not known Ronan then, and ethically Mr. Gray's profession was probably no worse than a professional mercenary, but it did not change that Ronan's father was dead. He reminded himself that the gray man had merely been the uncaring weapon. Greenmantle was the hand that wielded it. Ronan, silent to this point, said, I'm going to kill him. Gansey had a sudden terrible vision of it. Ronan's hands painted with blood, his eyes blank and unknowable, a corpse at his feet. It was a savage and unshakable image, made worse because Gansey had seen enough of the pieces separately to know accurately how they'd appear added together. The gray man turned swiftly. You will not, he said, with as much force as Gansey had ever heard from him. Do you hear me? You cannot. Oh, can't I? Ronan asked. His voice was low and dangerous, infinitely more threatening than if he'd snarled his response.
Colin Greenmantle is untouchable, the gray man said. He spread his fingers wide, hand hanging in the air. He is a spider clinging in a web. Every leg touches a thread, and if anything happens to the spider, hell rains down.
Ronan said, I already lived through hell. You have no idea what hell is, the gray man said, but not unkindly. Do you think you're the first son to want revenge? Do you think your father was the first he had killed? And yet Greenmantle is alive and untouched, because we all know how it works.
Before coming down here from Boston, he would have attached 16 little threads to people like me, to computer programs, to bank accounts. The spider dies, the web twitches. Suddenly your accounts are wiped clean. Your younger brother becomes an amputee. Your older brother dies behind a wheel of a car in D.C. Mrs. Gansey's campaign immolates over faked scandalous photos. Adam's scholarship vanishes. Blue loses an eye. Stop, Gansey said. He thought he might throw up. Jesus, please stop. I just want Ronan to understand that he cannot do anything stupid, the gray man said. To kill Green Mantle is to end your lives as you know it, and what good will revenge do you? Says the killer, Ronan said. Now his snarl was back, which meant he was hurting. Says the killer, yes, but I'm good at it, Mr. Gray replied. Even if he was not a spider in a dazzling web, would you be willing to go to prison for the satisfaction of killing him? Without a word, Ronan departed through the front door, slamming it. Gansey didn't follow. He was torn between the impulse to mitigate Ronan's pain and the one to let him stay hurt but cautious. Violence was a disease Gansey didn't think he could catch, but all around him his friends were slowly infected. Persephone brought the gray man a drink. She had another one of her own. They knocked them back in unison. Want this? Blue asked Gansey. She tipped the yogurt container to him so he could see that all that was left was the fruit in the bottom. He didn't nod, but she brought it to him anyway, giving him her spoon. It had a grounding effect. The shocking slime of the blueberries, the sugar hitting his stomach, empty from school, the knowledge that her mouth had been the last thing to touch the spoon. Blue watched him take the first bite and then turned quickly to Mr. Gray. He's the one who came for a reading last night, wasn't he? Yes, Mr. Gray said, as I thought. And now he is teaching Latin to the boys. Why? Gansey asked. Why us? Not you, Mr. Gray replied. Me. Clearly he didn't believe my story of fleeing with the Grey Warren. He came to this house looking for Mora because he thinks she is important to me. He has infiltrated the school because he has found out that you and I are acquainted. He wants me to know he knows I am still here, and he wants me to know how much he knows about my life here. What do we do? Gansey asked. He was beginning to feel like this day had been a mistake. This was not the real first day of school. He should have stayed in bed until tomorrow and tried again. He's not your problem, he's mine, Mr. Gray said tersely. He's in my school every day. Ronan has to look at his face every day. How is that not my problem? Mr. Gray said, because it's not you that he wants. I will address it. Your problem is to let me address it. Gansey sank to a crouch. He believed in Mr. Gray's intention, but not the statement. If he had learned anything in the last year, it was that everything in this town was tangled up. Calla took Mr. Gray's wrist and slowly pretended to break his arm. Shaking his head a little, he traded with her, taking her palm in one hand and her wrist in the other. He turned it with slow precision, a few times, so she could see how he was doing it. There was something satisfying about watching him competently demonstrate this act of pretend violence, something controlled and beautiful, like a dance. Everything about his clean, muscled appearance and clean, intentional process said, I've got it under control. Where it stood for everything. How badly Gansey wanted to let Greenmantle be the gray man's problem. But again, he saw that narrowing black tunnel and the pit and at the bottom, a grave. Calla cursed and held her shoulder. Sorry, Mr. Gray said to Gansey. I'll find out what he wants. Don't get killed, Blue said immediately. I don't intend to. Persephone finally spoke up in her tiny voice.
I think it's good. You've nearly found that king.
Gansey realized she was speaking to him. Have I?
Surely, Calla said. It's taken you long enough.
12. That night, not long after he returned from work, Adam heard a knock at his church apartment door. When he answered it, he was first surprised that the person on the other side was real. And then he was surprised that the person was Gansey and not Ronan. Oh,
he said. It's late. I know. Gansey was in his overcoat and his wireframes. He had clearly tried to sleep and failed. I'm sorry. Have you done your calculus yet? I can't get number 4. He did not say the word Greenmantle. There was nothing more to say until they heard more from Mr. Gray. I have, but you can look at it. Adam let Gansey in, sweeping the letter, behind the little shelf by the door as he did. Unlike Ronan, Gansey appeared out of place inside the apartment. The hipped ceiling cramped him more. The cracks in the plaster were etched more starkly. The utilitarian plastic bins containing Adam's things seemed even more bereft of aesthetic charm. Gansey belonged with old things, but this place was not just old, but cheap. The letter was hidden, yes? It was. Adam could feel the outline of it glowing from behind the shelf. Gansey would pity him and hire a lawyer, and Adam would feel like dirt, and then they would fight. We will not fight. Gansey tossed off his overcoat.